six, so or 87. So that's the first thing. Maybe I would have stuck with it longer. In terms of like the past, what would I have done different? Well, I don't know how much you know the history of everything that happened between that and specifically what Raquel and I were involved with the downfall of ESCOM. But I sat with Manfred Schmidt at the Commodore bankruptcy hearing in New York City and helped. I was holding the $10 million check myself that I handed to Manfred when he handed it to the bankruptcy trustee. They were a 7% shareholder of Viscorp for about one day, and that was sort of a difficult period of our lives. But in fact, we didn't change anything because, you know, either we're stupid or we're persistent. We never gave up on the idea of what we could do with the operating system, or at least in that environment. So I don't know. If I was smarter, maybe I wouldn't have been as persistent. So that ought to tell us about some people in this room too, you know. Anyway, that's it.
Anything for you, Ben?
If I would have known that my hair would turn so gray, you know, I wouldn't have done it. So, no, seriously, I mean, it's been software development is so unpredictable in terms of the. That's my major lesson, really, that I've actually that I had to learn the hard way, is that when the software developer tells you it's going to take 2 weeks, triple that, and then have another 2 months, you know, because there are so many things going on that are so unpredictable that's why we eventually adopted the when it's done attitude. And you know, John Carmack from ID Software, he's definitely a very smart guy, because that's really the only sane attitude. You know, I used to put forward release dates, and then we would miss them, and everybody would get on my case. So that's what I've learned. So no release dates. So, but well, you know, and gray hair. But that's about it.
Well, that's okay. You know, I think gray hair is distinguished on a 16-year-old. Jerry, I think this question also could apply to you. Here you are. You know, late now in the development on your Commodore One, I mean your the cone, as I've been calling it.
I think if I would do something different from the start of my Commodore One project, I think I would have chosen some platform that I could make some money at. You know, something that I could sell a million of instead of like 300 or something. Yeah. So yeah, I guess that's maybe 3 years of this was a little bit of.
This one's specifically to Jens. Jens, have you considered the law enforcement use for your new software? Is it a potential computer forensics tool to read formatted hard drives?
The software that we're developing is not targeted at hard drives at all. It is targeted only at disks and floppy disks, you might call them. But it has already been used by forensics and forensic specialists. The first of them were was the Computer Forensic Department of Defense. They had a suspicion that a set of disks contained illegal porn, child porn, and the cat weasel sadly proved that it was true. There are two companies in Germany that are also using the cat weasel as a forensic tool, and yes, this software that we're developing can be used can be used as a forensic tool. Yes.
Thank you. This one here is to Bill Buck, but again, this is one that I think has broad applications. So let's take it to the panel, but we can start with Bill. What drew you to the Amiga in the first place?
Well, I sort of talked about that already. I mean, I had some familiarity with it when we were working in Viscorp. Certainly, the guys that were with us in Viscorp, they all had Amiga backgrounds. I mean, Carl Sassenrath was part of the original Amiga OS team. Don Gilbreth had just come from working on CDTV. At one point, Raquel and I had a meeting with R.J. Michael there in our offices in Chicago as a guy who was potentially going to come over, but at that point it was a little bit too late for us to be thinking about recruiting people like that. By the way, we're still in touch with R.J. In fact, we traded emails with him a few weeks ago. So I think it was probably a combination of being involved with people that were frankly involved a lot more with the Amiga than I was, and Raquel, and just working with them on that project, which kind of kept us motivated and in the game, so to speak. Yep.
Ben?
Well, I used to own a Commodore 64, and I was pretty passionate about it, let's put it that way. I learned myself, I taught myself 6510 assembly, I think it was, and the other day I was trying out how good my memory was, and I was poking all kinds of color registers in the VIC-20, the VIC chip, DO20 and DO21, the hex numbers, and that was like, I believe it was 9 years ago that I last did that, and I could even reset the machine, so I don't know what's going on with my memory. Maybe I'm going senile. Anyway, so the Commodore 64 and then the Amiga, it was a natural transition. I think serial number 105 or something with the Amiga 1000, the one that had like 256 kilobytes of memory. You had to boot up the operating system for floppy and the kickstart. And then from there on, I was just an ordinary user, kept using the thing forever. And then I was forced professionally to use Windows, and I said, what the hell's that? It did all kinds of things very strangely. I mean, you used to format a floppy, and the whole system ground to a halt. And I thought my computer was badly configured or something. Found out it's actually that's the way it's supposed to work. So, okay. So eventually, when I saw an opportunity, I came back to it, and I decided let's try and do something about it. I was at an age where I could throw around some money and try to make things move, and it started as being a bit of a hobby, and then it got progressively more serious, and before I know it, I'll probably be committed to an insane asylum, but before that we definitely do intend to deliver OS 4.
Thanks.
Yeah, my story of the Amiga is similar to Ben's. I had a C64 before and was of course reading about the Amiga in the magazines, and of course couldn't really afford one because it was like 6,000 Deutsche Marks back then, about $3,000. I kept dreaming about it, and I've seen my friends buy Amigas. I've seen other friends buy Atari STs, and to be honest, I was seriously thinking of getting an Atari ST instead of an Amiga 500. But being a hardware person, I chose the Amiga because of its chipset and its color graphics, the nice sound, and so on. That really caught me to the Amiga. And I didn't really realize how far ahead the Amiga operating system was already at that time, and that's what kept the Amiga alive, in my opinion. It's preemptive multitasking that wasn't really a standard in the Windows world, and it proved to be the thing that kept the Amiga alive until today. Today, I'd say the chipset is not as necessary as it was back then. Today, today an Amiga is defined by its operating system.
Of course, I started out with C64, like I said also earlier, and I think I moved on to Amiga just some maybe misguided trust in Commodore or something that they would actually support the Amiga, so that's how I ended up in the Amiga.
Thanks, everybody. Let's see. I will point out one thing. There's a suspicious number of questions for Jerry here. Yes, and you're right. And most of them come from Ben. Jerry, for you, what OS does the reconfigurable computer run now, and what OSs do you see it running in the future?
The current boards run no operating system right now. They're not functional yet. The last prototype ran the C64 operating system, the kernel, and there is plans. Other people want to port their cores. There's a guy in Canada that's done a Apple II core, and then there's someone on FPGA Arcade that's done a VIC 20 core, and. I'd like to just make a C64 core with a lot of extra features, like more colors and graphics and stuff like that. Hopefully someone will patch the operating system to use it.
An extension on that, just out of my own curiosity, has anybody, perhaps in the MAME teams or anything, approached about porting cores of old arcade games?
Yeah, well, the person that runs FPGA Arcade wants to port some cores, like he has Pac-Man and Millipede, some other ones. So yeah, we'll probably end up with some arcade cores in there too. So it should be fun. I'm pretty excited as soon as we get the kind of a framework set out so other people can do it, because it's such a tremendous amount of work that I can't possibly do it all.
Yeah, let me add that there is a programmer from Sweden. His name is Adam Dunkels, and he has made the Contiki operating system for the Commodore 64. It runs on a plain Commodore 64. It's the size is 42 kilobytes, and it's a fully web-enabled system. It contains a web browser, a web server, a VNC server, and an IRC client, all in 42K. And of course, don't laugh, it's for real. You can download it on the net and try it out at your home.
Yeah, there's also, if we're talking about future operating systems, there's a lot of people making lots of noise about making operating systems for it, but there's one person made an operating system called Wings and JOS, which is some kind of preemptive multitasking operating system also that runs on a C64. And he also wants to put all the drivers to support PCI cards and stuff like that in it.
Yeah. Let me add that this Contiki operating system is also open source. It's written in C, and it has been ported to other computers before within a few days. So actually, the programmer of this Contiki operating system and the guy who's helping us out with the early startup procedure, they meet this weekend in Sweden at this Little Computer People meeting. It's a hacker meeting organized by C64 Freaks for C64 Freaks. And they meet there, and Adam Dunkels will see the Commodore 1, the C1, sorry, the C1 for the first time there. And they're gonna probably going to port this thing within a few hours, because these guys are hell of programmers. They can do it.
Thanks, everybody. Question here for Bill Buck. Of the OSs that you've mentioned for the Pegasus, how many could you name them, and how many are open source, and how many are proprietary?
Yeah, I can do that. Of course, you can also visit the website if I fail to mention one. There's seven flavors of Linux, with the pretty well known ones like SUSE, Mandrake, Gentoo, Nopix. We just have that running. Of course, Debian. How many did I name? Five. Let's see. What did I leave out? Yellow Dog. Six. No, actually, we don't. There may be a port to Red Hat done by somebody, but I can't claim that yet. There's another one, and then of course we have Open Darwin being ported now. Open BOS is pretty much running already. QNX is running already, but not completely. New OS is the 64-bit operating system that I kernel that I mentioned. Let's see, Pascal is being ported by some crazy Hungarian guys. They apparently use it for some fairly still important stuff over there. All the BSD flavors, open, free, and net. And what did I forget, Damien? Did I remember? Nate, wake up, tell me. Oh, yeah, the Amiga Research OS. That's being ported right now. And Zynot just started being ported. And Zeta is coming. So that's a BOS community thing. Anyway, how's that?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. Ben, for you, question is, what applications are you aware of that are currently being ported to OS 4 or are planned?
Let me see. It's hard to give a complete list. We do have a couple of developers of current applications for the Amiga that are still under development as beta testers. We got people like Darren from PageStream. He's an OS 4 beta tester. We got Felix Schwartz. He's an OS 4 beta tester. We got Davey Wensler, the audio evolution guy. And there's probably a whole bunch of other guys that I'm forgetting right now. So the eyebrows people, obviously. So more or less, we're talking to everybody who's still doing somewhat commercial development on the Amiga. I mean, with commercial between brackets, you know. But anyway, so we're talking to these people, and overall the response has been very favorable. So we will get those applications over to OS 4. What OS 4 allows is for the applications to be migrated one library at a time. You could start out with most of the things still 68K code, and then migrate like one library that does a lot of CPU intensive stuff. And you could mix the two together, and it would be completely transparent. That really cuts down on development time. You could do it gradually. And the other thing is, of course, that we've developed a whole set of tools to migrate OS 3.x source code to OS 4 with as little pain as possible. But obviously, we need to go outside the Amiga community to attract big names back to the platform, and by big names I don't mean Microsoft, because that's not going to happen. But there are companies out there that make valuable products that can be persuaded to license their code and to have it ported to OS 4. I mean, an example is, for instance, Realsoft from Finland, who used to make the product Real 3D. It's now called Realsoft, and they're still in business making their software. It's a really affordable 3D rendering and modeling package, and that's actually being ported to OS 4 by somebody working for Hyperion. So it's actually been under development for quite some time, and we haven't been able to allocate the resources to that we wanted. But that's the model that we're going to be looking at initially, is to enter into license agreements. I just suddenly remembered we're getting Candy Factory 2 by Xeon Neo. That's also coming for OS 4. Probably at one point we'll need to put up a more or less complete list, and I'm going to pour a lot of booze into Kermit tonight, and then I'm going to make him sign a contract where he basically commits to porting ImageFX to OS 4. So don't go anywhere, Kermit.
Bad news, I don't drink.
More bad news, he works for Genesee. No, that shouldn't hold you up.
Yeah. Okay, for Jerry here, as so many of these now are, Jerry, how badly did the theft of your original C1 board affect the development of the C1?
Oh, yeah, that was really bad. I was in Chicago 2 years ago. I went there with my hand-wired prototype, and I had thousands of hours hand-wiring and wire-wrapping and soldering connections on it. It was probably the most compatible out of all of the prototypes I've had up to this point. We were running different programs and some games on it. But anyway, I stopped at a gas station, and I was dumb and left the keys in the ignition of the car. Someone ran up, hopped in the car, and drove off with it and the prototype. So it set me back a lot, because I had coming from doing hardware into doing hardware in kind of a code form, I really didn't know that you were supposed to comment your code often and a lot. And I'd been writing everything down on paper. And that course, I took that, my only copies of that with me, and it was in the car. So it set me back many, many months just trying to figure out what the heck I was doing in some of this hardware coding that I was doing.
Follow-up question. How many pieces would you like the thief to be rendered into?
Six? 12? No, it's got to be a power of two.
8-bit. Eight. That's the answer. Eight bits. Okay, I'm going to just go through some of these Jerry questions here. Jerry, how much work would it take to develop an Amiga 500 2000 core for the C1?
It'd be an awful lot of work. It's not really geared towards that. You know, it's more of an 8-bit design. So I don't expect that.
Jerry, and by the way, so far there's pretty much never been the same spelling of her name on any of these notes. And only one's been right.
It's J-E-R-I, by the way.
Jerry, what do you feel the market is for the C1? Do you feel it could become anything more than a niche hobbyist machine, or is that all you want of it?
It'll only be a niche market machine, I'm sure. And that's really what I want of it. I mean, it's, I really want the true nerds to be playing with this thing. It's, I just want to fill the void of what, where the C64 isn't there anymore. We don't have anything like that where you can just control a machine so entirely.
Jerry, will we ever see a 3 gigahertz Commodore 1? Signed, Jim with a big heart.
Probably not. Not for many years until the hardware gets faster.
Now we're just down to Jens. Jens, given that the Amiga 1 and Pegasus can both use generic PCI and AGP cards, where do you think your market is going to be in a couple of years for these?
I haven't thought about that yet. I mean, I know that these computers can use standard PC cards, like TV graphics cards and so on, but I guess there's, since the user base is somewhat special, Amiga-like, there's always going to be a market for special applications. I mean, my market has been expanded with the Catweasel. It has been expanded into the PC market, and by that, I'm also targeting the Pegasus and the Amiga 1. So I'm not really worried about that.
Thank you very much. Again, for Jens, I've heard a lot about disk formats and how you do the research. I have some MSX and Draco discs that I would like to read. Is it possible to do this with anything that you're working on?
I'd like to split that because it's two totally different disc formats. One is really easy, the other is a little more complicated. The Draco part is really easy because, as I already told you, this signaling pathway, the different modules that you can choose, it's already there for Amiga discs, and it is already there for PC discs. And a Draco is kind of a crossover between a PC disc and the Amiga disc. It is basically a PC disc with the Amiga filing system. So what you just do is take either the PC disk and exchange the file system, or take the whole scheme for the Amiga disks and exchange the low-level decoding, and both will lead you to be to reading a Draco disk. The MSX is a little more difficult because the file system is not 100% standardized. But the low-level encoding is standardized because MSX was a standard back then. Some different computer vendors tried to standardize something to have exchangeable modules, exchangeable media, and so MSX is pretty well documented. So that's also going to be pretty easy to implement. I guess the low level is also kind of PC-like. So yeah, it sounds easy. But of course, I can need help. If any one of you has a disk at home that he thinks should be implemented, no matter how weird it is, I'm interested in it.
Thank you. And 8-inch floppies.
Yes, of course, 8-inch ones. Yes. There are little adapters that that are commercially available to connect 8-inch drives to any floppy disk controller, which includes the Catweasel. And there are other programmers who have been writing software, for example, to read TRS-80 disks, 8-inch disks. And this 12-inch, I've never seen those. You have? Well, it's going to take a... Okay, provide the drive, maybe. That'll help, yes. But 8-inch disks are also welcome, yes. And anything you know about them.
And the final question for Jens. You seem to have described a software rescue model that can also be interactively translating any file to any file format. Is this accurate? And where can the open source results be accessed on the web?
They cannot be accessed yet. This research project is planned for 4 months at least. The first software release is planned for October, but as we have already heard from Ben, that software development is not really predictable. We have started on July 1st, officially. We started a little bit earlier, but yes, it is possible to use this or to misuse it as a general file converter, but every single direction has to be made as a separate thing. So you cannot write a converter for, let's say, BMP files and then convert anything that you already know into BMP. So it's got to be a piece of software that knows both formats. So, as I said, for example, the conversion from a Koala Painter C64 picture into a BMP is one piece of software, but if you want to translate the Koala Painter picture into a GIF or a PNG, it's got to be a different piece of software. So it's not really geared towards universal file conversion. It's just an extra that can be added.
Well, correction, actually. ImageFX can translate between all those formats. Nice. You should buy a copy.
Hey, Kermit, I just wanted to do one thing before you closed it off. This is our first Amiga-centered show in the United States, and as you may or may not know, as we get ready to move to the next phase of what we're doing, we're let's say, bringing in a new batch of, players to the team. And since this is our first Amiga show, we thought this was probably a good time to announce our first round draft pick for the next team that we're about to field. I'd like to tell you that Michael Jordan is about to join Genesee, but it's not true. We have settled instead for the very capable, very proficient Wayne Hunt. So Wayne Hunt is... I got a jersey here for you, Wayne. Maybe I could just hand it to you real quick. Should have number 32 on the back, but we'll just have to settle for Amiga Org, yeah? Yeah. So. So anyway, I just had to slide that one in there.
Well, I'd like to... before we close down here, ask our panelists if they have any final words for everybody. We'll start with Jens.
Final words. I get a lot of emails from people that, first of all, ask, can you really make a living? Because they are somehow don't believe it. And on the other side, they hope that... that I can, because they think that my work is making computing a little more individual, and that's what I'd like the computer world to be. It's not to be the whole one big ocean where everyone is the same, but where every single computer can be something special, and I think the Amiga is something special, and therefore is a platform that's worth to be maintained.
Ben.
I have only a few words. Please buy an Amiga 1.
Jerry.
I just wanted to thank everyone, all the support emails I get. It really helps me continue. I mean, there is a lot of times I wanted to just throw in the towel and just quit, but it's really great to to see the excitement, with this really long project. So I think that's about it.
Thank you. And finally, Bill.
Yeah, like Ben, we flew from Europe yesterday. We left the apartment at 6 in the morning, and got into our hotel room here with the time change and everything at about 6:30. So if I talk much more, my lips are going to start messing up, and I'll go out of seeking or something. So I think we're finished for here for us anyway.
Well, thanks to all our panelists here. And thanks to Zach and Brian and Chuck there, who've made this all possible. I'd like to have a round of applause for them.
And thank you from us to our panelists. Thank you very much for participating. And this is all that that I had really hoped for. In fact, it's a lot more than I had hoped for. So I really appreciate your comments and your insights into the various areas you participate in. Tomorrow morning, the show opens at 10. So just bear that in mind when you're participating in the after hours functions, and don't want to miss too much tomorrow morning. So I think that just about does it for this evening. Thank you for coming, and you have really helped to make all of the show what it has been so far and what it will be tomorrow. Thanks very much.
Okay.
That concludes the banquet.